It is harder to get pictures of the ruins here because so much of the city has been built over. This is modern Izmir, a metropolitan city of some import. If you were flying into western Turkey today, this is probably where you would land. It's about 40 miles north of Ephesus. It today fills very much the kind of function that Ephesus did in antiquity. This picture is taken across from is taken from Mount Pegasus. Karifakale, across the Gulf of Sin, it's called. This is the city that was destroyed about B.C. 600 by the forces of Lydia, of the king of Lydia, Aliates, who reigned at Sardis, about which I'll say much more shortly. Then the survivors were dispensed into the villages, and the city was rebuilt by the successors to Alexander the Great in about 280 BC. So this was the city that died and that came back to life again, and the believers in this city were feeling that they were about to die and to come back to life again. But as we've seen, in fact, they were really quite courageous. Go ahead, please. Again, a similar view looking a little more to the north, showing more of Mount Sipolis in the distance. Go ahead. This looks down again from Mount Pegasus more closely at the city. There are bare patches of the Roman Agora in the middle distance there, the marketplace. Go ahead. One does not see so much here. This is a bit of a washed out one. But here, these are houses here, if you look closely, and these are ruins here. So it's one of the few areas where you can see the ancient ruins actually present. So it's not as visually as exciting as some of them. Go ahead. Here you do see some of the ruins at the bottom of the Agora. The Agora was the marketplace, like our malls. It was the marketplace. But in the marketplace, you not only did your marketing, but that's where people hung out and debated and talked and so on. When Paul is in Athens, if you recall, in Acts chapter 17, we're told that he taught daily in the Jewish synagogue, trying to convince Jews and proselytes about who Christ was, and also in the marketplace, because that's where people hung out, you see, and that's where he was finally challenged and brought into the council. But you can see these massive arches here to show three levels of this original marketplace. It was a three-tiered marketplace. Go ahead. Some of the massive arches at the bottom level. Go ahead. Now, one of the recurring themes in the book of Revelation is this crown of life, or crown of something, crown of glory. And there are quite a few of the ancient ruins that look not unlike crowns. In fact, some of the ancient writers picture the ruins of one city or another as crowns, or the crowned head of Mount Pegasus you find in the ancient sources. So that it might be with comments, the crowned head of Mount Pegasus, where in fact the local pantheon was held, where the temples were, the gods and so on. As opposed to this, what Jesus promises to give is a crown of life. So by contrast with the paganism and the temple worship, the emperor worship that is bound up with the ancient world, the crown city of Smyrna was known. That's the way it was sometimes referred to. But what Christ gives again is crown of life. Point, counterpoint. Again, please. Okay, now, I should say one more thing about the last place. Smyrna was also where young Polycarp was martyred some decades later. I don't know if you've heard of Polycarp or not. But Polycarp and Papias were two early Christians who, according to the early sources, actually knew the aged Apostle John. And so they become a very important link to Irenaeus. Irenaeus writes some of the most important stuff in the ancient church up to 200. He writes a lot of his stuff about 180. But the point is, Irenaeus, as a young man, knew both Papias and Polycarp, who in fact knew John. You've only got a two-generation jump from apostolic times all the way to Irenaeus, which is very interesting, you see. Polycarp was martyred, ultimately, in Smyrna. We're not sure exactly of the date, middle of the century, roughly, middle of the second century. So he did suffer there at the stake and was given the crown of life. Now we come to Pergamum. You're approaching it now from the sacred way. This is the view towards the Acropolis of Pergamum. The Acropolis was the area where the gods were maintained, the various pagan temples and so on. This was a city built on a mountain of dark granite. The road shown connects the city on the hill with the temple of Asclepius. Notice that there's a gash in the mountain. That's where there's a modern road that goes through. Go ahead. A closer view of the Acropolis now through the arch of the amphitheater. You can see part of the road heading toward it, the gash on the mountain where a modern road goes. Notice the crown on the top again of the ancient ruins. That's why so many of them were built on hills, you see, and it gave the impression then with the ancient walls of being a crown, you see. So the crown imagery becomes particularly telling in that kind of framework. That's the theater toward the top of the mountain. We'll get closer to it, not only the crown, but you can see the theater here. It's not very clear, but we'll see those steps. And there, of course, the crown itself. This was, of course, where Antipas perished, probably in that very theater. Go ahead. These are Hellenistic walls. That is slightly later walls of the Acropolis at the top of the mountain. In other words, some of the old walls were eventually battered down, and these are slightly later ones. But certainly... the same sort of thing. Imagine trying to take a city like that. You see, you've got to get up there, and then while you're trying to scale the walls, you've got people pouring boiling oil down your head and things like that. Go ahead. Yes, this is from the top, looking down. The Acropolis looks over and governs a huge area of ancient Mysia. There's an aqueduct running through there, but we'll see a better aqueduct a little later. Well, I'll just point it out to you. This is an aqueduct here that used to bring water to the city. But we'll see better aqueducts at Laodicea in a few minutes. Go ahead. Now you can see part of the modern town of Pergamum at the bottom. This is part of the ruin of the old theater. See the immensely steep slides. This is part of the gash of that old road, of that road that's gone through now. Okay, keep going. Still some excellent ruins. Notice the difference between the white and the dark stones. We'll come back to that again. This is the ruins of the temple of Dionysius, Kathegemon, Dionysius the leader. Go ahead. There's the terrace below the theater. See how sharp it is, how steep it is? That is almost certainly where Antipas died, in what is in fact a theater at the bottom. Go ahead. Further picture of it, a little farther up. Different setting. Yeah. Beg your pardon? Like what? Yeah. I mean, you might know some sports complex like that that I don't know about. Yeah. Go ahead. Okay. Now then, this is worth saying something about. This is part of the ruins of an ancient library. Pergamum, at one time had a library that began to rival the library in Alexandria. The best library in the ancient world was the library in Alexandria, in Egypt. And King Eumenes II, at the beginning of the 2nd century before Christ, was building this thing up and building this thing up and building this thing up. And it began to rival the Alexandrian library, so Egypt forbade the export of papyrus, which was your basic paper material, to the Pergamum dynasty, to the Attalid dynasty, it was called in Pergamum. But this place was so wealthy at the time that instead of using papyrus, they began to use what we call vellum. It was really a kind of paper made from the skins of animals, which was, of course, a lot more expensive because you had to kill the animals. Instead of just growing papyrus, you have to kill the animal. I will say more about the nature of papyrus and scrolls and so on next week because it affects how you interpret chapter 4. But eventually, this library, which was superb and on vellum, so the stuff would have lasted longer, and second only to Alexandria, later on, once the Romans took over, and the seat of government was eventually moved to Ephesus. The library still stayed here. But when after Julius Caesar was killed, you know, A2 Brute and all that, he was killed, and war broke out between Mark Antony and Octavian. And Octavian then eventually wins and becomes Augustus Caesar, for those of you who remember your Roman history. Well, during that struggle, Mark Antony had half of the troops, and he went around the eastern end of Lake Mediterranean and stopped here on the way by on his way to Egypt. He eventually joined forces with Cleopatra in Egypt. He had an affair with Cleopatra, and both he and Cleopatra were destroyed by Octavian, who became Augustus Caesar. But on the way, he swiped the entire library as a love gift for Cleopatra. So thus, the library in Alexandria thus had both libraries. And then later on, when it was destroyed, both were destroyed. So all of that wonderful collection is gone forever, forever, forever. Those are the estimates, yeah. Imagine 200,000 volumes. I mean, that's about the size of Trinity's library, which is a pretty good library. We probably have 140,000, 150,000 bound volumes, and another 100,000 of microfiche. And you can think of the space for it that it takes, you see, besides the usage. And then on animal skin as well, these scrolls, most of them, not codices. I mean, it must have been a huge place originally. So you don't see much of it here. But that's a part of this. Now, in fact, our word parchment comes from the word Pergamum. Because this vellum that was used, you see, to make their parchment was so common there that people said, oh, yes, that stuff's a Pergamum stuff. You know, it's Pergamum. And hence we got our word parchment from that. Okay, go ahead. Three inscriptions about the 2nd century A.D. There is some interesting insight here into city life. The council and people honor various persons for services rendered. On inscriptions at the center and at the right, Pergamum is described as metropolis of Asia and twice Neocaros, first city of the Pergamenes. And you see how proud it is? Now, it wasn't twice Neocaros, that is, having the right to erect two temples to the emperor, or emperors to two temples. It wasn't twice Neocaros in John's day, it was only once Neocaros, but once was enough. And then later in the second century, it had a right to do it again. Neocaros literally means temple sweeper, but it was an envied title claimed by cities permitted to have an official temple for emperor worship. These inscriptions are in the temple of Asclepius Soter, Asclepius Savior, because he healed people, the god of healing. Go ahead. Pergamum, if you recall, was Satan's throne, and I indicated that that's variously explained. This is the altar of Zeus Soter. Zeus was the head of their pantheon. It's like Jupiter in Latin. Zeus was the head of their... And this was the temple to Zeus. Now, because it was the head of the temple, because it was the head of the Greek pantheon, it may be that this was viewed as by Christians as the place where Satan dwelled. The head of the pantheon had his temple here. So it may have been then because the city was Neocaros, emperor worship. It may have been because there was a Zeus temple there. Or it may be because there was an Asclepius temple there. We'll see one of the little symbols in a moment, which had the symbol of Satan. But all three of them could have called forth this, where Satan dwells. Maybe it was the combination of them. You know, you guys are putting up with everything there, where Satan dwells. Go ahead. Note the sculpturing of serpents on the stone. That's because of the Asclepian influence. Serpents are found on the famous... coins of Pergamum and in all the cities of the Attalid period, which Christians would see as an emblem of Satan. Okay, next. Model of Temple of Trajan, which was a little later, but it's only a model. It's the ruins are so bad one finds it hard to reconstruct it. Go ahead. This is the alternative model built on the same design. This one's in East Berlin, or what used to be East Berlin. I won't go into that here. Go ahead. Yes. Here, too, you have another temple cult. And what I want you to note now is the dark stone again with white stone. Now see the next picture. You see the dark, dark stone and the white stone? You have the whole mountain of this dark granite and then white stone for various inscriptions of one sort or another. And that, I suspect, is bound up with the white stone language here. White stone was used in a variety of ways. White and dark stones were used in court cases. when judges, for example, had to cast guilty or not guilty, they would drop either a light stone or a dark stone into the hat. You see, white meant not guilty, dark stone meant you were guilty, and thus to have your name written in, I will give you a white stone, is a way of saying you will be declared not guilty in my presence. You see, it's a way of saying God will find you not guilty, and the white dark, because of the granite and the marble that was the white marble that was used for some of these inscriptions, would probably stand out that way with a new name written on it. Now, the names are ways of saying that God recognizes you. People put the names of people who would donate a lot of money to the local temple, the way we put plaques on wall when somebody donates $100,000 for some furniture for the new wing or something like that. We have a little plaque. They would put up a marble thing. So this is white stone with a new name given on you that only God himself knows, you see? So it's another way of saying you're secure, you're lasting eternally, your contribution is being recognized, and on top of that, you're not guilty. I mean, all these symbolisms are all bound up together, you see? And the people would have recognized it at once, even though some of the symbolism is a little strange to us. What do I want a white pebble for? You see? But it was clearly meaningful to the first people. Go ahead. All right, now we come to Thyatira. This is a great contrast with Pergamum. It is quite unremarkable and visually unexciting. The modern town is called Akizad. You can see the name of it on the signpost here, Akizad. And 60,000 people or something like that today. It's not a very big town. And because it's built over the old site, there's not an awful lot to see. But we'll show you some things anyway. Go ahead. That one doesn't count. There's an Akizad in a snowstorm. Yes. This is a shoeblack area of town. You can get your shoes blackened. And this is a drugstore. Turkish, if you recall, it was written in Arabic script, and then it was switched in the 20s, at the end of the Ottoman Empire, was switched over to a Western alphabet script. So it's a language that is structured like Arabic, but that it's spelled in Western letters. And it's a very interesting and very difficult place. Modern Turkey. Go ahead. There's some other things here that are interesting. Now, these are copper shops, obviously. Great tourist buys, if you like this sort of thing. And the workshop for it is behind. Now, this and other trades are interesting, and they're grouped in separate quarters of town. And in the ancient world, they had trade guilds, not entirely unlike our trade unions today. The trouble is that each trade guild had a patron deity attached to it. So that if you were a skilled copper worker and you became a Christian, you could be in a lot of difficulty, because part of what was expected of you to belong to the copper trade guild, you see, was that you would go along to the appropriate temple and worship the patron god or goddess of that particular guild. And if you couldn't do that, you couldn't remain in the guild, like you couldn't remain in the union. If you couldn't remain in the union, you can't hold down your job. And so some of the things that are said in some of these letters about how they are poor and this sort of thing, and their poverty is tied to the faithfulness of these believers, may well be bound up with these sorts of trade guilds. All through here, in Thyatira, at this time and in previous times, these same sorts of trades have been passed on from generation to generation, from generation to generation. And it was a copper smelting place way back in the first century with a trade guild and a patron deity that was involved. Do you see? So some of these things may be bound up with some of those sorts of things. In fact, there is one very important word in 1:15:2:18 that the King James Version calls fine brass. It's not found anywhere else. His feet are like fine brass burnished in the furnace. In fact, some of the language is drawn from the Old Testament, which is used in the Danielic visions of one who's so strong that it pounds down everything in front of it. You see? But in fact, that word is not found anywhere else in ancient Greek literature. And some have thought, that made a good case for it, in fact, that the word for rendered fine brass is in fact a trade name, like a Hoover. Now, a Hoover is simultaneously a trade name and a kind of machine, you see. And this may be the best brass. His feet are like the best brass. Only now, instead of the brass that is corrupting you and making you poor because you can't get in on it because of the pagan connections, his feet are fine brass that trample down all the enemies in his footsteps, you see? There may be a mingling of metaphors along those lines as well. Go ahead. This is the mosque. You can see the spire of the minaret. This is the main mosque in Akhisar. What is interesting about it is that inside there are some pagan images, which shows you the amount of syncretism today. But syncretism existed in the first century as well. And that was the danger of Jezebel, wasn't it? A kind of spiritual whoredom. Syncretism exists again and again and again. Don't you find it in the book of Acts? The seven silly sons of Siva? Do you like the alliteration? The seven silly sons of Siva? Well, what were the seven silly sons of Siva into? They were into black magic, for goodness sake. They're supposed to be Jews. And they were into black magic. So the danger of syncretism can happen again and again and again and again, especially in a highly pluralistic society, unless your principle, the highly pluralistic society, can turn you into some kind of syncretist. Do you see? And that's what was happening in this part of the world as well, as it's happened again in the Grand Mosque. All right, now, I think what we'll do is I'm going to press on with the rest of them now and then come back to the text. Why don't we finish the slides now? We haven't finished, we've got Sardis and Philadelphia and then Laodicea. So we come to Sardis. This is the view of the Necropolis Mountain. There are two mountains here again. And this is the Necropolis Mountain with a whole lot of little caves in it where a lot of people were buried. Necropolis, city of the dead, that was their burial grounds. And then the city where they lived was more on this side where more of the ruins are. You'll see this green belt in here. That's the Pactolus River, but which I'll say more in a moment. So this is we're approaching Sardis now. The goddess Artemis, the same one Diana that you find in Ephesus, is very important here. The river Pactolus runs at the bottom of the valley. The mountains on the back there have about 1,100 cave tombs, dating from the Lydian period, which reached its apex under King Croesus. I don't know if you've done any sort of Greek mythology. King Croesus, 6th century BC, was proverbial for wealth. And he pushed the Lydian Empire so strongly that at one point it was threatening the Persian Empire. It was extremely powerful for being such a small thing, and it was because of the wealth. He could get the troops and he could get the best arms. And the reason he got the wealth was the Pactolus River. They did placer mining gold all through there. Do you see? And so the old Greek myths of King Midas touch. Now today Midas is to do with mufflers. But in Greek mythology, Midas, remember King Midas? Everything he touched turned to gold. That's what he wanted. And then his wife turned to gold, and his kids turned to gold, his food turned to gold. He couldn't eat or anything because everything he touched turned to gold. So he prayed to the gods, and his Midas touch disappeared. But the very fact that there could be rumors of that kind of stuff around is because this whole area didn't know so much gold, you see? And King Croesus, there was an expression, a simile in the ancient world, richest King Croesus, or richest Croesus. And that expression was still used in some 19th century English literature. You know, the person, Rockefeller, he's rich as Croesus. Now, that's going to today because there's so few people that know the ancient Greek mythologies anymore, you see. But he was built here. He built here. He became rich here. And Sardis was his chief town. Go ahead. Slopes of some of the Necropolis mountain. They've been hollowed out in the friable material. Eventually, people use some of these caves for hiding in extreme danger. And that may be evocative of some language in Revelation 6, which we'll see in 2 weeks, where the people go and cry. They hide in the earth, save us from the wrath of the Lamb. Hide in caves, the king's generals and so on. It would be very powerful language here because that's what happened on two or three occasions when Sardis was attacked. People went hid in the caves. Go ahead. Oleandus plants by the river Pactolus. This is the stream which in legend was where Midas washed off his golden touch. And of course it's where Croesus, centuries later, then found gold. So probably the finding of gold is bound up with legend, with how the gold got there. You see, the gold touch was washed off. He had money. Croesus had money, arms, allies. Details can be filled in with pictures from other sources, Lydian coins, and so on. This whole area was proverbial for wealth. Go ahead. The Acropolis of Sardis. You can get a good picture of it taken from the Necropolis. Notice the earthen bank in the foreground. The city of Sardis was proverbially impregnable. It was thought impossible, in fact, to attack, because so many of the cliffs were this friable material that would all break away. They were so steep and so on. In fact, the city was taken twice. Sardis was taken twice. It was taken exactly the same way that Quebec City was taken in my country, in Canada. Quebec City was taken by the English under James Wolfe in 1759 from General Montcalm, and it was taken exactly the same way. One cliff was judged just too impossible to climb up, so they didn't guard it. And that's where the troops went up. They found a rabbit trail up, and they went up at night, and the next morning the troops were already there, and they fought in the Plains of Abraham and shot each other. Both generals were killed, but the English won. And that's how Canada became English instead of French. At least it became bilingual instead of French. Now, in the same way, you see, Sardis was judged absolutely impregnable. You'll see why. Next photo. The city's on top of things like that. It's all friable material. It will break away. But in fact, twice the city was taken. So the Christians here will see, you see, are in danger of thinking themselves absolutely impregnable. We'll look at the text again in a few moments. But in fact, the city has a reputation for being so wonderful, as the church there has a reputation for being so wonderful, but in fact it is in enormous danger. Go ahead. More of the same. Imagine taking troops up there. Go ahead. Looking down from the summit of the Acropolis with a temple below and Necropolis Mountain opposite. Again, the river Pactolus in the middle distance. You see? Notice in Revelation 3, you have a name that you live, but you are dead. Watch, therefore. You see, that language is taken right out of the whole mythology of Sardis. You've got a name that you're impregnable. In fact, you're dead. You keep watch. Go ahead. Again, a view of vineyards and so on from the top of the place. Go ahead. The Acropolis from ruins of the later city on the plains to the north. Go ahead again. This is the reconstruction of a synagogue about 1970 when the picture was taken. This was originally a 3rd century AD synagogue, but it was built in an immensely wealthy place. Probably it was where the ancient synagogue in the 1st century was also built. The influence of Judaism is variously attested here, but probably it was pretty important. Go ahead. Reconstruction of the gymnasium about the same time. Note the reference here in the text to white raiment that was given to the conqueror, the one who won the races. They raced naked in those days. That's why women were not allowed at races. Only the men participated. The women were not allowed because the men were all naked. It was a peculiar Greek form of sexism, I suppose. But in any case, the winner then was given white raiment. And so the winner in Christian forms here is given white raiment. The symbolism is the same. Okay? This was an ancient center of clothing manufacture as well. Next. I'm skipping along at a glorious pace now. This is a general view across an area that has vineyards and so on in the Philadelphia area. The modern town of Al-Sahir, with a three-pointed Acropolis, is in a hill behind. Notice the tents down there? They are red crescent tents. The Muslim equivalent to Red Cross tents, which were put up in 69 because of earthquakes. This whole area is an earthquake region, especially around Philadelphia, a particularly apropos subject at the moment. And we have a number of Japanese students at the seminary, who some of whom have got through to Kobe and some of whom cannot get through at all, and have no idea how their relatives are doing. Because phone lines are down and so on. We've heard that some of the churches in the area, 3 evangelical free churches in Kobe, are all still standing, believe it or not. And the pastors have still survived, but many people have died. It's been horrendous. Well, this whole area was like that. You'll see some evidence of it, and the importance of this to the text you'll see in a moment. This is the other church, which is small and pathetic, but which in fact receives only commendation from the exalted Jesus. Go ahead. Now you're looking on the modern town. This town looks weak. How on earth can you defend a town like that? In fact, it's never been taken in history. for one reason or another. So this town, which looks weak, turns out to be strong. Like the church here looks weak, but turns out to be strong. Sardis thinks it's so strong. In fact, it's been Sardis has been taken, so this church is about to be taken. Do you see? So some of the same imagery is picked up. This town was founded by one or both of the brothers Eumenes II and Attalus Philadelphus. Philadelphus, hence the name Philadelphia. And it commemorated commemorated in name because of the brothers' brotherly love. That's what Philadelphia means, for his brother. In AD 70, it suffered catastrophic, AD 17 rather, it suffered catastrophic earthquake and many shocks afterwards, and then some smaller earthquakes after that, with the result that the imagery of stability here for the overcomer is very telling. I will make you a pillar in the temple of my God. Do you see how the language is picked up? Over against this insecurity, you seem so weak and you're suffering, like your town is weak and suffering, but I will make you strong. You will endure. This city has never been taken. You will not be taken, and you will become a pillar in the temple of the city of my God. See, the language is being taken up from the local history. Go ahead. More of the same. Again? Now, this picture, the last pictures, the previous pictures were taken in 1964. This one was taken in 1969 with a collapsed house in a field just outside of Philadelphia. This was a farmhouse, because this picture was taken just a few days after the famous Al-Sahir earthquake of 1969. See, and what had happened here, it happened in the first century as well, and destroyed things, and then the imagery is taken up, you see, by Christians. Go ahead. So you see a lot of collapsed homes and these red crescent tents in various places, people living outside. And what do you read? You know, he will no more go outside. What do you do in an earthquake? You get out. You go outside. You live outside. You live outside tents because you're afraid of the aftershocks that bring things down on your head, you see? So the point, the mark of stability then, of being in a perfect place, is that you will no more go outside. You're now a pillar in the temple of our God that's secure, and you will no more go outside. See, the language is being picked up from the history and so forth of the time. Go ahead. This hollow... Do you see its hollowed out place here? It's never been excavated entirely. But this hollow is the stadium. Again, it looks like a crown. And Jesus says, the exalted Jesus says, let no one take your crown. Probably crown of life, sign of victory. But the crown imagery was common all through here because of all these stadiums and all of these cities. Okay? More red crescent tents with a town half broken down. Again? All right, this is a transitional photo, and it's rather important. This is the river Lycus with Mount Cadmus in the background. Notice that you're at sufficient elevation here to have snow. You're in the Lycus Valley now, and the Lycus Valley is home for three important New Testament cities: Hierapolis, Laodicea, and Colossae. All three, they're all in the Lycus Valley. But the Lycus Valley has almost no good water. I mean, that water doesn't look exactly wonderful, does it? It's got hot springs in Hierapolis. We'll see them in a moment. So people went there, the French would say, to take the cure. In French, you go to take, je vais prendre le cure. You go take the cure, you see? So you go to the hot springs, and you go and sit around and get cured. And then Colossae, we'll see, had the only fresh water in the whole valley. Laodicea had nothing. Now, this is part of the Lycus Valley system. Keep going. There's not much left of Laodicea. This is part of the water tower, and part of the structure on the left is part of the old gymnasium. But this was an important city. In its time, it was right on the road that connected the Roman Empire with the East, India. If you wanted to go through to India, it went through Laodicea, you see? And as you went, just like today, when you go to another nation, you have to change your money. Once you move out of the empire, you have to use non-empire funds, you see? And so this became a banking center. This was a money-changing center. So it was wealthy. In addition, it was also a place where they had a lot of sheep farming, but a certain kind of black sheep that produced a heavy kind of cloth equivalent to our jeans material. I mean, jeans isn't for the best wear. You know, it's not exactly posh, but at least it wears well. So this dark black wool was strong. It was tough. It was good quality stuff. But on the other hand, it wasn't considered posh or classy. And some of that language comes up here. I counsel you to buy from me raiment. You see, white raiment, the sign of purity again. And these people thought they were wealthy, but in fact, in some ways, they were quite poor. In addition, this center had an ophthalmic institute, an ophthalmology institute, a place for healing people with eye diseases. In many, many Near Eastern countries today, as then, You could get eye infections because of dust and bits of fecal material in the air mingling with the dust, and would get in your eye, and you'd have terrible eye inflammations and pusses and swelling and so on. So they developed here a kind of poultice. People don't know quite how they did it, but they developed a kind of poultice which you'd slap on the eye and would suck out the poison, and they had a fair bit of success with it all. So there was an ophthalmic institute here, you see, and so they think that they can see well. So the imagery is all coming through here. You think that you can see, but you're blind. You think that you're well-dressed, but you're naked. You think that you're wealthy, you see, from all of this money stuff, but you're poor. And the church has taken on the characteristics, you see, of the entire city in that regard. Keep going. Now, this is what's left of the stadium. You can see what's bits of the stone seats you see sticking out of here. It's all grown over. It's never been completely dug out. Laodicea, like Philadelphia, occasionally suffered from disastrous earthquakes. In AD 60, according to Tacitus dating, there was a great disaster here. But here, the people were so filthy rich, they never even appealed to the imperial government release fund. I mean, just like we have a federal disaster fund today, you know, they're pumping in billions again into California now, into 18 counties there because of all the flooding recently. Oh, I heard a terrible joke the other day. San Francisco has had fire, flood, drought, and earthquake. All it's missing is volcanoes, and then it can become a full-service disaster area. Wasn't that awful? But, well, in any case, the ancient Roman Empire, just like America today, had a federal relief fund, an imperial relief fund. Laodicea was so filthy rich that when it was destroyed in AD 60... they rebuilt it without any help, thank you. They actually wrote to the government and said, we don't need your help, thank you. And there, you can find little plaques. So this was rebuilt at our own expense. They were proud of it. They were filthy rich. They could handle it. And they were proud. And the church was rich. Could handle it. And didn't need anybody's help either, thank you. They didn't know how poor they were. Go ahead. What's left of the water tower and an aqueduct? Now, although this city was at the crossroads for east-west traffic and from some north-south traffic, and had this manufacturing business from the sheep farming, and had this ophthalmic center and banking center and eye salves and whatever else it had, you see, it was missing one thing. It didn't have a good water supply. And so what the Romans did was pipe water in. Now, they used stone pipes. We'll take a look at them. It didn't come from the hot springs at Hierapolis, and it didn't come from Colossae. It comes from another place. A lot of the older commentary says it comes it's hot springs from Hierapolis, but when you actually get there and you look at the site, the pipes are all going in the wrong direction for Hierapolis. They brought it in from somewhere else. But it was hot spring water in any case, with a lot of chemicals in it, calcium carbonate, things like that. And so by the time this water got to Laodicea, it had all these chemicals in, and it was lukewarm. Was disgusting. Made you sick. Cicero and others comment in the ancient world that it was the foulest water in the entire empire. Cicero traveled through here. Milwaukee, did you say? Well, when I grew up in Quebec, I lived on the St. Francis River, and we used to say that it was the foulest river. There were three sawmills upstream, and in those days they didn't have the controls on them that they have nowadays. And when you get a low water day or dry summer, it just stank. It was awful. dirtiest river in Quebec. We said, well, this was the dirtiest river in the empire, according to Cicero. And he traveled east here and changed his money here. So he probably knew. So often this verse has been understood. You know, I wish you were hot or cold, but because you're lukewarm, I will spew you out of my mouth. Often that has been understood in a spiritual sense. I wish you were spiritually hot or spiritually cold, but because you're spiritually lukewarm, I'll spew you out of my mouth. But why would God want somebody to be spiritually cold rather than spiritually lukewarm? I mean, are there any odds on that? It misunderstands. I don't think that anybody in Laodicea would have taken it that way. The point is, right in the Lycus Valley, in this here area, we'll look at them in a moment, there is a town that is known for hot springs. Well, the drinking water may not be all that wonderful, but you can go and take the cure. That's good. The hot springs are useful. They're valuable. They're cherished. They're good. Then there's a town like Colossae with the cold water, the only cold water in the whole valley. That's good. What has this place got? Good for nothing water. The point is not that they're spiritually lukewarm, but in fact, they're useless. They're neither hot useful nor cold useful. They're neither hot appetizing pleasing nor cold appetizing pleasing. They're just like their water. Revolting. Disgusting. That's what is meant. So now you have, if you please, the resurrected Christ, the exalted Christ, saying to his church, you disgust me. That's what he's saying. You're so disgusting that I want to treat you the way you treat your water. Take a little sip, gag all over the place. That is the way God, the exalted Christ, is picturing his church. Isn't that a damning indictment? Go ahead. Now, these are the stone pipes that bring the water in. And when you get closer, you see, there's the outer ring of the original diameter. But from the calcium carbonate, it's filled in this much. And that's the amount of chemicals that are in there that just got deposited. We'll get closer. Go ahead. See again, outer ring? And the amount of deposit that's been filled in. Go ahead. Now you're moving off to Hierapolis. Go ahead. Hot springs at Hierapolis. No, that's not me. Go ahead. See, and you can see all the chemical formations from these hot springs. You can see them all, and but they really are very beautiful indeed. You see again Mount Cadmus in the distance and so on. And you went there to take the cure. Go ahead. Now, of course, those telephone wires weren't there in those days. But it really is. At least that was hot and useful. It was hot and good. Go ahead. Now you're coming to Colossae, which has never been excavated. It never has been dug out. And I'll show you the only springs there in the whole valley. Go ahead. That's, you were just on the edge of it before, now you're closer to it. That's the Colossae thing that has never been dug out. Go ahead. Those are the springs. The only fresh water in the whole valley. One more. Now we're back at the gate of Laodicea. This is Laodicea again. The railroad tracks weren't there either in those days, in case you wondered. Most ancient towns, in times of security and plenty, would leave their gates open at night. Because somebody might be traveling along and need a place of shelter, and they would come in. In a place that was dangerous, either because there was political unrest or there were a lot of brigands around or something like that, then they'd close the gates at night, and you couldn't get in unless you knew a password, or you just have to stay out in the morning, or you could prevail on somebody to believe you enough to open them up or something, you see? Gates shut at night, and then you were locked out. But at this time, most of the towns around here were so secure that they left their gates open. Not Laodicea. With all this money, with all this wealth, with all this arrogance, this feeling that we've arrived, they shut their gates at night. Thank you. In fact, when they rebuilt their gates, they did it, you know, a little placard. So-and-so donated so much money and repaid for this gate all by himself and this sort of thing. You see? After the AD 60 destruction. And then they shut their gates at night. Thank you. What does Jesus say? Behold, I stand at the door and knock. So again, that would speak very powerfully to those people. Now you must understand that he's not addressing that to the individual who's contemplating becoming a Christian. There's Jesus sort of standing outside the sort of 19th century shuttered door with long blonde hair and blue eyes. And there's a little nice little lamp there and he's knocking on the door of your heart. That's not the image at all. It's Jesus knocking on the door of the church. It's being addressed to the church. He's been shut out of his own church. The way this place shuts people out of its town. They're so arrogant. They think they've got everything under control. They think they're wealthy. They think they can see. They think they can make people see with their eyes out. And in fact, they're just nauseating to them. So there's one side of Jesus that's knocking on the door of the church and saying, I must be inside or you will be destroyed. And there's another part that's saying, quite frankly, you are so disgusting to me. I want to retch every time I take you. That's it. If you want to shut that off. I sort of followed it, and I've made allusions to a number of things in here already. Are there questions you want to raise about these letters, two chapters in the last few minutes before we break up? Because next week I'm not coming back to them. We've got to keep moving or we'll get too far behind. Next week we'll do chapters 4 and 5. Oh, yes. Yes. There's, again, probably a double allusion there. It's something coming from the Old Testament, too. The manna. The manna is picked up regularly as a symbol for life, and it's picked up by John in John's Gospel. So the real manna is Jesus. He gives the bread of life. But in Pergamum, where you've got this contrast between light and dark stones, and the lighter stones connected with the judicial system and so on, it was a hidden sort of thing. People put their hands in. You weren't supposed to see what kind of stone they dropped into the thing. It was supposed to be a blind system and so on again. One suspects again that what Christ gives is not flashed out there in the public arena. It is manna that only he gives, but it is hidden. It is secreted. It is not in the public arena that draws immediate attention. It's probably in that kind of framework that it's being offered. I should have said more on the stones when I was there. Yes, you want to say something? Yeah, various people have tried to make this purely horizontal. Others have made it purely vertical. My guess is you can't have one without the other. You certainly can't have any sort of knowledgeable love of God without loving men and women. John says as much in 1 John. James says as much. And it may be that just as in 1 John, he then, after a while, doesn't bother putting in direct objects. We love because he first loved us. Not we love one another or we love God. Just we love because if you got one, you've got the other because he first loved us. So also here it isn't specified. And I would be reluctant to make it just one or the other. But that means that if I didn't mention both, I was also remiss. No, I didn't. Yeah, that one is more disputed. The morning star, of course, is really an appearance of a heavenly luminary that announces the dawn of the morning. That's why it's called the morning star. So Jesus, defined as the morning star, is probably simply being pictured as the one who is announcing the dawning of the consummated kingdom. Is there any connection with this city? That's not so sure. Some have wondered, however. Many of these ancient cities were heavily into astrology of one sort or another. And so this becomes the true astrology, as it were. Jesus is the one who is announcing the dawning of the kingdom. I'm not sure that that's correct. But the reason I like it is because a little later on, we'll see in our last session together, in chapter 21 and 22, something of the way the temple is configured in the new heaven, not the temple, but the city is configured, the new heaven, the new Jerusalem. It's configured in one particular, exactly opposite to the signs of the zodiac, almost as if it's saying, whatever they do, we do the opposite. So there may have been astrological influences all around here, which were also then viewed by any Bible believer as being basically aligned with the devil and to be opposed. Within that kind of framework, then, the true morning star is Christ. He announces the dawning of the true age. But it's not certain. Yes? No, I don't know. No, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, one could guess a profound significance, but it's very hard to guess on the significance of what isn't there. It's like appealing to an argument from silence. Unless there's a reason for thundering noise, arguments from silence are very precarious. These are the words of him who is holy and true and who holds the key of David. What he opens, no one can shut, and what he shuts, no one can open. Clearly, that's bound up with the future of this town, too, in some ways. You see, he really does control all things. And that much is mentioned back here. No specific mention to opening and shutting, but he's in the place of God and controls all things. And then the closest to it is at the end of the vision, verse 18, he says, "And I hold the keys of death and Hades." What he shuts and opens even extends to heaven and hell. So there is that small reference to what he says. Okay? Shall we call it quits? Next week, God willing, chapters 4 and 5.